You're listening to A Country Breakfast on RN. Let's get out and about with our rural reporters. This week, Sentinel Chickens put themselves on the front line to protect Victorians. We find out about bucket wine and join the pistachio harvest in South Australia. And speaking of nuts, we investigate a mysterious sweet treat that comes from a row of walnut trees. And we meet mobile butcher Matt Christensen, who loves life on the road.
Yeah, I just started doing a few on the weekends for a bit of beer money, and it escalated from there. Just had enough of being inside a butcher shop, and I wanted to change my lifestyle a little bit. And this sort of gets a bit of both, you know, you're outdoors talking to people and going around the paddocks, and, you know, then the rest of the time in the back of the truck.
Lots of ground to cover today, so let's get started, beginning with a chicken coop in northern Victoria.
Could you just, like, stab a needle in there?
Oh, you'll see in a tick, actually. Yeah.
Right across Victoria's northern border, tracing the Murray River, from Wodonga in the east to Mildura in the west, chickens are putting themselves on the front line, and it's all for our benefit. G'day, I'm Warwick Long, here at a primary school in Barranduda, near Wodonga, where a flock of 20 very noisy chickens are about to get their blood tested. They're part of what's known as a sentinel chicken flock, an early warning system to detect insect-borne diseases. Each week, from November to April, a small blood sample is taken from each bird in each flock in 9 different locations. District Veterinary Officer with the Department of Environment and Primary Industries, Dr. Jeff Cave, is responsible for testing the flock.
Well, the idea with the sentinel chicken flock is that they're an early warning for a couple of diseases, Murray Valley encephalitis and Kunjin virus. And so we've got 9 sentinel chicken flocks dotted along the northern part of Victoria. The idea is that there is an early warning system. If either of those two diseases is found in the sentinel chicken flock, then the Department of Health uses that as an alert that those diseases are present in the community. Chickens are quite a good indicator for the disease. Being birds themselves and being a virus which is circulated in wild birds, it makes chickens quite a good indicator for the disease, and so that's why they're used.
Well, there's 20 chickens and they're not going to sample themselves, so I suppose we better go inside and have a look.
Okay, let's do it. They came here just at the point of lay, so they're probably around about 20 weeks old at the moment, or 21 weeks old at the moment. So what I do is, once a week, we take a small blood sample from them and put that on a piece of filter paper, and then we send that down to AgriBio, which is down at Bundoora.
And how much blood are you taking from a chicken at a time?
It's just a drop of blood. So it's kind of almost like a pinprick of blood that comes out, and then we absorb that on the piece of filter paper. I've been doing this program now for about the last 15 years, and you become fairly good at just working your way systematically through the chooks and causing them not too much in the way of stress, so I think it probably doesn't really affect them at all. And actually, I'm fortunate here at the school because I've always got a few students helping me, which makes it even a little bit quicker. So probably a minute a chook, something like that.
And when do you get the results for the tests on the chicken blood?
What tends to happen is that we send the blood samples down, and it's a bit of a case of no news is good news, because for most of the season we'd almost expect to have negative results come back, and it's only if we have a positive result come up that we get asked to go out and rebleed the chickens.
We're in a shed with the chickens here. You've got a box of goodies. Before you get started, how much stuff do you bring with you?
Well, as you say, it's a fairly small box of things that I bring along, and I guess the important things that are in that box are a pair of gloves to put on, a packet of needles which we use to make the blood come, and then some filter papers that we put the blood onto, and then we put those pieces of filter paper onto bits of blue tack so that they can just kind of dry in the breeze.
All right, well, I suppose we should get into it then.
Okay, let's, we'll get a hold of a chicken and we'll sample it.
Are they easy to catch?
Yeah. So what I tend to do is just see the one that's closest and handiest to catch, and then it's just a case of picking it up off the floor. And from there...
So you go for under the wing, is that...?
Yeah, so from just under the wing, there's a vein called the brachial vein, which is quite easy to see. And with a fine needle, I just prick into that vein, and then you'll see a drop of blood come forth.
There we go.
Like that. And get a piece of filter paper. So from there, I just dip the filter paper where that little bit of blood is. Look at the number on the leg band of the chicken, so I know which chicken the samples come from, which is number 86. Right, 86 on that sample. Mm-hmm. And then through this sliding door, I'll just slip the chicken outside so that I know that it's been done and so that I don't pick it up and do it again.
These guys are right until next week now, aren't they?
That's right. We'll be back here about the same time next week.
Take some grapes, a bucket, a sieve and a funnel, and hey presto, you've got wine. Hello, I'm Sophie Malcolm in a vineyard near Merbein in northwest Victoria, where winemaker Bart van Olfen is going back to basics. I'm standing in his workshop, which is sort of like a cross between Willy Wonka's chocolate factory and a high school science lab. In here, there's about 15 big glass jars filled with grapes of all different varieties and colours. And that sound you can hear is them fermenting away.
So bucket wine started as a bit of a joke and by coincidence. We found a bucket in the vineyard and my wife didn't know about winemaking. My background is winemaking. So I said, well, let's ferment it. Let's do it really basically without adding any yeast and see what happens. And loved it. It actually tasted quite good. So the next year we made 10 buckets and a bit of white wine in demijohns. So we've got lots of things to experiment with and lots of winemaking techniques to make different wines. And it's all the reds are still made in little buckets and all the whites are pressed in buckets. And the only thing we use is buckets, a sieve and a funnel to make the wine. So it's all pretty much manual, no machines involved and no chemistry involved. It's tricky, but it's also really basic. The yeast does the job for us. So if you think about, there's yeast all around us. So as soon as you crush something and you expose yeast and sugar in the same area, it starts fermenting. So, and as long as you sort of control and be really clean, so nothing interferes except the yeast, you have wine a few days or a week or 2 weeks later. So from that principle, it's pretty easy. The trick is to keep it clean and keep it sort of nice. So we use the fridge to settle the wines down, so get them clear. And for the rest, it's we use a little bit of sulfur as a preservative in the end of fermentation, and that's it. So the bottles, the wine is cloudy, and there's still a little bit of lees, and lees is dead yeast cells in the bottom of the bottle, but that's part of the charm.
Can you describe what it looks like when it's sitting in the sort of bottles?
Yeah, so there's lots of different size glass bottles that are like big round bulbs. There's all shades of different wine colours in there. So all shades from really white to quite yellow. Then we're making rosé, so there's really light salmon colour rosé till quite a dark raspberry coloured rosé. And then we've got some white grapes that we left the skins in the demijohns. They're sort of green with little bits of grapes floating in them. So yeah, just lots of colours.
It's a bit of an experiment. Have you had anything go wrong?
Well, it's funny because with my background in winemaking and quite commercial winemaking, I see everything that's wrong with it really early and I freak out. Then my wife and her sister calm me down and say, no, we're not tipping it out. We're not tipping it out. We'll just wait. It might come good. And I've been proven wrong a few times that it's tasted awesome after a year. Took a year. But there's also wines like... We tried to make a sparkling with all the yeast still in it. And when we opened it, it was just one big foam fest. So yeah, that that wasn't quite what we wanted. We're still working on that one.
Is there any potential of making it a big, I know you've sold some of it, but making it a big commercial sort of venture?
Well, I think we're actually limited ourselves now because people expect it to be in a bucket and a demijohn. We can't make it bigger. And I think that's also part of the charm, that there's people out there that they had to buy the whole batch of wine when they bought it. They're the only ones that have that wine. So we only make 2 dozen or 3 dozen, and they're the only ones that have that wine. So it's a bit exclusive. If we make it bigger, then it might lose its charm. We can make more demijohns, but not in a bigger. And also it doesn't work in a bigger because we can't. We're technically sort of limited by that. So we're trying to every time find new things to experiment with. We've got 40 different varieties here, 70 different clones. So there's lots to still experiment with. It's about wine, not taking too serious.
Winemaker Bart van Olfen explaining how to make bucket wine to our reporter Sophie Malcolm. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, we taste a mysterious sweet treat, we go on the road with a mobile butcher and find out how they get the pistachio nuts off the tree.
All this crashing and banging behind me is good news for pistachio lovers. This year's nut harvest is underway in orchards along the Murray River in the northeast of South Australia. G'day, my name's Clint Jasper, and if you've ever found it tricky splitting those tiny shells open, spare a thought for the growers as they try to get these nuts off the tree. Some favour old-fashioned means, others use mechanical harvesters. I'm going to check out both ways today, starting on Martin Simpfendorfer's farm, where they've brought two trailers, two tractors, seven people and a bunch of aluminium poles out into the orchard.
The way we're harvesting is with two trailers that pull along the trailer. Along the ground, and we've done that ever since we've had the trees in harvesting. And as I said, we've been here over 40 years, and so we made these a few years later when the first harvest came along, and that's done quite a good job for this rather than the mechanical shaker.
Pistachios grow in cycles of heavy yields, followed by lighter ones, and for Riverland producers this year, it's the light cycle. But despite that, most of this year's orchards are still carrying above average yields, and even though about 100 millimetres of rain fell just before harvest, producers here are still very happy with this year's crop.
These are pistachios on here, and they're, well, we think a bumper crop. They're not all like this, but they're beautiful bunches. It's like a bunch of grapes, really. And you can see some of these are getting soft and the husk is coming off them. And as you take the husk off, you're left with the nut underneath.
So yeah. Is this splitting of the husk, is that a normal thing?
Yeah, that's a normal thing.
Yep.
But the rain has made that a bit worse.
Okay.
There's one, a green one you can eat like that. And Lebanese people love them like that.
Mm.
Yeah, so that's an exceptional bunch. And they, like almonds, if you were to hit that with my hand, I'd probably knock half that bunch off because they're all just hanging there loosely.
You can see that just then, you kind of lightly tapped the bunch and about four of them fell to the ground.
That's right.
And now they're ready for harvest, Martin and his small team will spend the next week or so getting them off the tree. But as uni student Dylan from Kangaroo Island explains, it won't be easy.
It's a good hard day's work. How long have you been going for today? Today, about 5 or so hours. We expect to do a fair few more hours today if the weather will hold out.
While the harvest on Martin Simpfendorfer's farm uses one of the most traditional methods of pistachio harvesting, there are other ways.
What I'm looking at here on Jay Roediger's property is two separate pieces of machinery working side by side. There's a giant, almost conveyor belt that's moving along and shaking the trees. It's pretty much removing all of the ripe fruit, and it's a lot faster than, I guess, what we saw at Martin Simpfendorfer's place.
I've been using the mechanical harvester for the past 8 years. I've been a pistachio grower for 8 years and have used it every year since.
So you haven't ever used the aluminium sticks and catcher method?
Oh, I have used a catcher. I've got a catcher myself, but I haven't resorted to bashing sticks, no.
And so I guess the main benefit would be the reduction in labour costs. How many people do you need here to get harvest underway?
Well, myself, we first go through and skirt all the trees, and that probably hire 4 to 6 people. And then, yeah, then the contract harvester comes in and, yeah, I'll pay them, of course.
And so you don't own the harvester yourself?
No, I don't, nah. I own about 35 acres of pistachio nuts, and yeah, I can buy myself my own harvester, but yeah, not quite yet.
So across those 35 acres, how long will the mechanical harvester get through those?
I think the mechanical harvester will go through in about probably 24 hours, yep.
Is it running non-stop?
That is starting and stopping, but that's running time, 24 hours of harvesting.
Regardless of how they're harvested, the next stop most of the Riverland pistachio crop makes will be Victoria, where they'll be hulled and graded, ready to be enjoyed as a tasty snack across Australia.
Yeah, I just started doing a few on the weekends for a bit of beer money, and it escalated from there. Just had enough of being inside a butcher shop, and I wanted to change my lifestyle a little bit. So being outdoors, doing outdoor jobs, and this sort of gets a bit of both, you know, you're outdoors talking to people and going around the paddocks and, you know, then the rest of the time in the back of the truck.
For the past 13 years, Matt Christensen has been driving around the south coast of New South Wales in his trusty truck, plying his trade as a mobile butcher. And he loves every minute of it. Hello, I'm Alex Blucher, and I've caught up with Matt hard at work in the Bigger Valley, where he's busy slicing up a lamb carcass on Barry Hergenen's farm. A growing trend for homegrown produce, especially amongst smaller landholders and hobby farmers, has seen demand for his services rise, and he's booked solid for months.
Well, basically start from the outside. Got the 2-ton crane on the outside, which does all the lifting and controlling of the animals once they're slaughtered. Then they go into the back of the truck and off to a cool room, or the cool room stays on the property. Then basically it depends on the animal, whether it's a sheep, pig or beast. It starts on the rail, break it down, run through the bandsaw, go through the mincer, making sausages, mince, corned beef, all that sort of stuff. Lamb steaks, bone roll shoulders, all the juicy things that the customer wants, because they're in complete control of everything I do.
Why would people choose to raise and slaughter their own animals rather than go to a butcher or to a supermarket?
Yeah, because they've got complete control over everything that they do, from rearing the calf to what it eats, if they drench it at all, whether they go organic, and the satisfaction of doing it themselves, yeah.
And how does it change the taste or quality of the meat?
Well, you don't really get any rise in pH levels in the animal from stress, so that's the first significant part, and standing in a paddock, and the next minute's in your freezer, it's a lot better way to go.
And do you think that there is a greater role or awareness of self-sustainability and people wanting to know where their meat comes from and why people would choose this option?
Yeah, I think more and more so lately. Probably the 80s was a bad era for people just buying straight from the supermarket. So I think now, 2014, people are going more for what they can control and what they can consume.
Why do you think that is?
Fresh is best. But I think people lost the art for a while there on how to grow a garden and how to rear a steer and get their animals to a, you know, decent level. So people enjoy it. Better way to live. Farm butchering, it's the only way to meet.
Hi, I'm Barry Hergenen from Numbugger. For years I've been selling meat off the farm so others benefit, and this way you pick out the best and you've got the best for yourself. I had a dream of being self-sufficient at one time in my life, but it's pretty unrealistic. It's impossible to grow veggies all year round, but with meat you can have your own meat all the year round.
If someone was planning, they may not be a farmer, but they might want to raise one or two animals, what kind of advice would you give to them?
Oh, I think do it. If you get the opportunity, do it. It can be a lot of fun. One of the problems people run into is they try and run too many cattle on their little block. So talk to a farmer, somebody who knows, and just find out what you can run, because winter comes, you run out of feed. So you really need to just plan carefully what you're going to run. Buying stock, if you have to buy stock in, you want something that's quiet. You don't want something that's going to push fences and be forever going and get them out of the neighbours. There's a lot involved in it. That's only a couple of things, but just talk to somebody.
What's your favourite cut of meat?
Lamb cutlet. Lamb cutlet, yeah, beautiful. Love lamb cutlets. They're delicious. Every lamb should be made out of cutlets. Barry should breed one that makes cutlets only.
Keep an eye on me cutlets.
I always pinch cutlets from Barry. Very good.
Got this darker outside, and we've got this light brown middle bit, and then there's kind of a little hollow section. I'm still really not quite sure what we're looking at here. I guess the only way to find out would be to maybe to put it in the mouth and see what it tastes
exactly
like.
Exactly right. That's the best way. Nice thick syrup in there. The syrup on its own is just so nice.
It's unlike anything I've ever tasted, but delicious. Really delicious. G'day, Brett Worthington with you in Alina Gareffa's kitchen at Irimple in Victoria's northwest. Now, Alina's a bit of a dab hand when it comes to pickling and preserving food. Her specialty is chilies, but she's willing to have a go at anything that's in season. Her latest creation is a jar filled with mysterious small dark balls soaking in a clear syrup solution. So what's this mystery food then? Well, half the fun for Alina is watching people guess what it is they're eating.
Well, when I present this to somebody, because it's something a bit unique, I let him guess. I don't tell them what it is. First thing people will go for is the taste. So they like the taste. I haven't met anybody who doesn't like the taste. And then I'll ask them to have an indication of what it might be. And it takes a long time before they guess what it might be. Would you like to have a go at guessing what it could be today?
I'm going to say it's a fruit is what I'm going to put it out by saying.
Okay, so as I said earlier, if we have trees growing, and I'll try and make something out of what we've got growing. So we have a row of walnut trees down in front of the house overlooking the Billabong, a beautiful row of walnut trees which we planted when we bought this property 40 years ago. And we use the walnuts fresh and shell them and have them. And now I've discovered this other method where I can actually preserve walnuts in a syrup. And they are just so beautiful. You just can't stop eating them. And they're lovely on ice cream. And these walnuts are just black and they look like a plum. But they're actually preserved in a shell, which makes it a bit unique. And they're just so nice. And the ingredients in there is nothing artificial. It's all natural ingredients and preserved in their own syrup. Just beautiful.
I cannot believe this is a walnut. It's just, it blows my mind to look at it. Is anybody, when you say a walnut, do they all say, excuse me? How is that a walnut?
That is the reaction because normally a walnut, you can't bite into it. And this is, you've got the shell and all, you're biting into it. It's preserved in a way where you can actually cut into the walnut and serve half a walnut at a time. You can sit it on ice cream. You can put a bit of cream on it. And yeah, it is very, very, I'm just so excited about this product because it's only new to me. I've been now preserving it for, you know, only a short few years. So I'm really excited about it too.
So how did you come across this idea?
I was speaking to a friend and, you know, we're sort of talking about what we should do with walnuts and this idea just come about. Mm-hmm.
Mm. If we just have a smell. So what is it that's going into that syrup?
In the syrup, it's really the taste of the walnut, and there's sugar in it as well. But it's the taste of the flavours of the walnut that's coming out into that syrup that's giving it that beautiful flavour.
Because walnuts, we know, are quite tough. How long does it take to soften to this? This is quite it's got a firm outside, but it's really kind of malleable, and it doesn't reflect anything like what you would associate with a walnut.
No, it takes about, I'm just trying to remember now, about 6 weeks of working with that walnut before it comes to a point that you can eat it.
It's just got this lovely aroma that's coming out of this jar.
It's not alcoholic, but the syrup almost tastes like a beautiful liqueur.
Fruit and nut grower Alina Gareffa, always experimenting with new ways to use the dried and fresh fruit she grows on her property at Irimple in northwest Victoria. Brett Worthington, very willing taste tester there.